This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 27th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a look at how some local leaders make decisions for their cities. Plus, a preview of a concert featuring siblings Yura and Elisa Margulis, a conversation with the surveyor of the Queen's pictures for the Royal Collection in London, and more.
First, the House Revenue and Tax Committee is advancing a bill that would cap the state's spending growth after amending it yesterday. Republican Representative Bruce Westerman of Hot Springs says his bill is not a spending cut, but merely a way to rein in government growth. The amendment now ties the spending cap to the average rate of disposable personal income in the state, rather than to a formula that would limit state budget growth to 3% or less. Westerman says the bill's new formula will give the state incentive to keep taxes low.
I believe this is a great indicator, and I believe it works both ways. I think this will allow us to responsibly control the growth of government spending. It's a much simpler method of doing the calculation.
Disposable personal income refers to an individual's total income after paying taxes. The bill has passed committee once before, but House members refused to amend it. The governor and the Department of Finance and Administration have spoken against the bill.
Arkansas Speaker of the House Davy Carter is calling on lawmakers to make $150 million in tax cuts this session. The Republican from Cabot visited the House Judiciary, Public Health, and Revenue and Tax Committees yesterday morning, reminding each committee of the time frame of the legislative session. In the Tax Committee, he told lawmakers he was counting on them to wade through the over $2 billion in tax cuts they have before them in a timely manner.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking that the committee begin deliberations on your tax cut package in the total amount of $150 million.
Governor Mike Beebe told reporters that lawmakers will have to justify any cuts.
We can't even afford my number one tax cut right now immediately, which is the groceries tax cut, and still meet these obligations. So if they're going to cut any more taxes, they have an obligation to say who they're taking it from.
Speaker Carter also proposed cuts to the state's capital gains tax. The governor says he is working with the speaker on those types of tax cuts.
And speaking of Governor Beebe, Lieutenant Governor Mark Darr is standing by his decision to sign a bill into law while the governor was out of the state on business. Act 145 bans the public release of concealed handgun license records. The bill would have become law with or without a signature since Beebe didn't veto it, but Darr wanted to put it into effect immediately. Beebe says the lieutenant governor embarrassed himself by doing this.
I will be much more careful about what we do and when we do it. You got to be careful not turn your back if things like that are going to happen, because I owe it to the people. I mean, you know, they elect me to be the governor, and we know what a lieutenant governor is. It's a part-time job. He presides over the Senate, and if something happens that the governor is dead or incapacitated seriously, then that's what that's for.
Lieutenant Governor Darr is standing by his actions, saying he respects the citizens of Arkansas and the 130,000 citizens that are now protected under this law.
The Ozark Natural Science Center in Huntsville has announced that it will suspend its residential environmental education and summer camp programs beginning in May. The center's interim director, Jenny Harmon, says the programs are being suspended because of financial issues.
The program is an excellent field science program. It's a high-quality program, and it is an expensive program to operate. We charge the schools to bring their students here, but that cost, the charge to the schools, does not cover our cost to run the program. And it was just a matter of just resources. We were just short on resources to cover the program. So the decision was a difficult one to make, but we have struggled with this issue for some years, and it was a decision of the board that we just couldn't continue operating.
She says while the recession that struck the country beginning in 2008 didn't help the center's financial situation, the slowdown in the economy wasn't necessarily the cause of the center's fiscal distress.
It was actually an issue before the recession, but our charitable donations and the amount of money that we make at our big fundraiser, Call of the Wild, have not been as successful in recent years as they were in the past. And that has impacted our ability to operate efficiently.
Harmon says she is unsure of what will happen with the center's grounds and staff once the school programs are suspended.
A new study released by the National Park Service shows that visitors to national parks in the natural state contribute significantly to the local economy. The report found that in 2011, nearly 2.9 million visitors to all of the national parks in Arkansas spent about $151 million in the communities surrounding those parks, supporting more than 2,500 jobs across the state. In the northwestern corner of the state, the Buffalo National River greeted more than 1.1 million recreation visitors in 2011, generating more than $38 million in economic activity. Meanwhile, the Pea Ridge National Military Park attracted 114,000 visitors, generating just over $6 million of spending in the local economy. And the Fort Smith National Historic Site saw 86,000 visitors, generating more than $4.5 million of activity in that local economy. The study conducted by Michigan State University for the Park Service found that across the country, national parks generated $13 billion of direct spending by 279 million park visitors.
Clear tonight with lows in the lower to mid-20s. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs from 40 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 47 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. And partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows from the mid to upper 20s.
From deciding how our trash is collected to determining where people can park, city leaders are faced by many choices. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis spoke with some city leaders in the area to find out how those choices are made. Here is his report.
That noise you hear in the background is a regular occurrence in every city and town in existence. No, it's not the prelude to church services, though some probably treat the scene with similar reverence. In a few seconds, the proceedings will get underway and Fayetteville alderpersons will deal with matters of business concerning every resident of the city. Shh! The meeting's about to begin. Of course, the business dealt with by this or any other city council or board varies from meeting to meeting. Sometimes, few items on the agenda garner lengthy debate or discussion, while other times, one or more items of business can receive an hour or more of public input, especially if a vocal segment of citizens is opposed to a proposed ordinance or resolution. But sometimes, the most vocal opposition from residents comes in the wake of decisions not made at council meetings. Such was the case when Springdale city officials decided in mid-January to stop providing police escorts for funeral processions in the city. Springdale Mayor Doug Sprouse says that that particular decision wasn't an easy one for some residents to swallow.
I think in my 4 years in office, that's been the most controversial, no doubt. I mean, we've had other, had to make other tough calls, but that was probably the one that had the most negative public reaction.
He says that the decision to end the funeral escorts wasn't easily made. After both an independent efficiency study by the Matrix Consulting Group and a recommendation from Police Chief Kathy O'Kelly brought the issue to city leaders' attention, the practice of using Springdale police officers as escorts for funeral processions ended in the name of increasing traffic safety for both the city's police officers and residents.
In this particular instance, what made this so cut and dried for me is that I saw it as a safety issue. So it wasn't a political issue or a popularity contest. It was something that I decided, once there was a safety issue, then that had to be paramount in the decision making. It wasn't about whether it's popular or not. So in some ways, those decisions are, I don't want to say easier, because this was a very tough decision, but there's a justification that you're confident in, you feel you've made the right decision.
And Mayor Sprouse says he was confident in his decision, so after a few days of receiving negative responses from residents, he issued a press release detailing his reasons for ending the funeral escorts in the city. But he says that negative responses are the ones city leaders are most likely to hear from residents. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan tends to agree with that notion.
You realize you're going to get those kind of calls, but once it's settled within yourself and you have determined the path, the decision has been made and you go, okay, here's the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. and you know that not everybody's going to agree with you. And everybody has a right to their opinion.
And the city of Fayetteville itself is no stranger to tough decisions. In the past 5 years, there have been a handful of issues that have drawn the ire of vocal groups of local residents. Some of those decisions have included enactment of the paid parking system in the downtown area, a proposed smoking ban in all bars within the city limits, and the creation of the city's Streamside Protection Ordinance.
And the Streamside Protection Ordinance. We had over 15 hours of public comment in three meetings. So that one particular subject in that agenda was an average of 5 hours every city council meeting for three city council meetings in a row. And then from that, you hear everybody's side. And when I make decisions, I am open. I will have a plan, but I'm also open to listen.
For instance, paid parking today isn't the same as when it was first implemented. City leaders made adjustments to the plan two or three times in the first year of implementation alone. But sometimes the conflict with implementation of a city policy arises among the city's residents. That was the situation with Fort Smith's plans to automate all trash collection in the city. City Administrator Ray Gossack says that the city decided to go automated 7 years ago. City leaders intended on phasing in the plans implementation over a six-year period in order to manage the cost of switching from the older manual collection.
Then in the last year, there were some neighborhoods, particularly those that had some historic appeal to them, who objected to the change in how their solid waste was collected.
Not all of the neighborhoods in the final phase of implementation were opposed to the automated collection, but enough residents were against the change that they convinced the city's board of directors to halt the implementation of automated collection. But that wasn't the end of the issue. A separate group of residents who didn't want the rates charged for trash collection to increase organized a petition aimed at overturning the city board's decision. They gathered enough signatures to put the issue on the ballot, and the measure received enough votes to force the city to finish implementing the automated trash collection. Gossack says that the conflict arose from a lack of understanding on the part of some residents. He says that there is only one real way for conflict to be avoided in the face of difficult decisions.
We need to keep residents informed, and we need to keep them informed and involved as the decision is being made, not after the decision is made, because we typically, when there's a difficult decision to be made, it's not made quickly or instantaneously. And so there is time to alert the public to the issue, to provide information and facts so that they can understand and analyze the issue, and then hopefully have a better understanding of why the decision that is ultimately made was made.
And though his position isn't an elected one, Gossack says that the responsibility of city leaders is to make decisions that are in the best interests of the majority of city residents, as opposed to making decisions as agents of the public's demands.
I think that elected officials and senior city staff have a responsibility to make recommendations and decisions that are in the best interest of the greatest number of residents, and in the best interest both short-term and long-term. So, you know, many times we find ourselves balancing short-term interest as well as what's sustainable for the long-term.
Mayor Sprouse of Springdale agrees, saying that overall, city leaders must make the best choices for city residents.
But good minds can disagree on what's best for a city. That's where the difficult decisions come in. I don't mind making tough decisions if I'm confident in the decision, and I try and weigh those things. But the decisions can be very difficult to make because you are impacting the lives of other people. And sometimes you're called on to make a decision that helps one person and hurts another.
He says that the trick is for city leaders to weigh what they believe is right against the city's ordinances and resolutions to determine what is best for the majority of a city's residents. But Sprouse says that there is no universal approach to making tough decisions.
I think it depends on the situation. When you're talking about things like safety issues, you have to make the best decision for the public. You know, somebody has to make that decision, and because I'm in this position, then I've got to make that decision. In this case, it was to whether or not to support the chief's decision. But there are other times that you know, public safety is not the issue.
As an example, Sprouse says that city leaders are currently involved in a back and forth with developers wanting to build a truck stop at the intersection of Don Tyson Parkway and Interstate 540. Though he is not opposed to the truck stop being built in the city, Mayor Sprouse says that he is opposed to its proposed location because of concern for the overall impact it would have on future development in that part of town.
Some of the public agrees with that. I hope most public does, and the council has backed me on this. But we have gotten some pushback from some residents that believe, you know, we need the sales tax revenue. We ought to invite them with open arms. So, you know, it is a combination. It depends on the issue, you know, and the importance of that issue and the weight of that issue. I mean, I always invite public input, but sometimes it matters more than others.
But Mayor Jordan says that part of the Fayetteville administration's philosophy is to accept all input from the public when making tough decisions.
Everybody should have the freedom to express himself. Doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. I should be willing as a public servant, and that's why they call us public servants, to listen to a point of view. You see, here's the interesting thing. It's when you can sit across the table from someone that has an entirely different point of view than you do. And respect them for that and give them that type of freedom to express yourself, knowing that what they're saying to me is something that I'm not in agreement, but I listen and respect them for that point of view. That's when you're getting somewhere.
He says that it is part of the job to listen to input from all sides of an issue.
As a mayor, you're sort of a facilitator. You bring everybody together. And you try to come up with something that everybody, you're not going to please everybody, but the majority of the public can agree upon.
But the best way to know the issues that city officials are trying to solve, and the only direct way to voice your input on those issues, is to attend your city's governmental meetings. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Thank you all.
Representative Andrea Lee is the chairwoman of the House State Agencies Committee. The Russellville Republican is in her third term, and her committee will eventually whittle down as many as 37 proposals to alter the state's constitution to just 3, maybe even fewer. So how does she see all of this playing out? Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down with Representative Lee to find out more.
Let's talk about the process of constitutional changes. I think a lot of our audience probably understands that the Senate has some joint resolutions, the House has some joint resolutions. Walk folks that don't know the process through how you guys whittle that down and then get it to the point where you actually vote on what's going to be out there.
Well, senators file their bills, their joint resolutions, and House members file their joint resolutions. Each committee separately votes on what they want to send out, and then we meet jointly as a committee at some point. My understanding right now is Senator Williams is going to be hearing his joint resolutions like regular bills throughout the regular committee process. My plan right now is to have a separate committee meeting that hears nothing but the joint resolutions.
Let's talk about what you have seen filed on the House side. Just some of the things that come to mind in your neck of the woods. What do you think is most interesting?
Well, the one that's being discussed a lot right now is the ethics one. As you know, Regnant Populist, the citizens group, got together in ethics reform to put it on the ballot last time. And we have a couple, a senator actually, and a representative that are drawing one up right now that addresses some of those concerns. It's kind of, we're calling it an ethics bill. One of the other discussions I hear is dealing with term limits for legislators. Another one is dealing with the, and this was filed both in the Senate and the House, and that's dealing with the election of highway commissioners,
yeah,
as well as game and fish commissioners.
Yeah, and you filed one on highway commissioners.
I did.
Right?
I filed
me why,
one.
Why do you think that's good public policy?
You know, part of it is, and I'm not positive it's good public policy. I think it's worth discussing, that's for sure. And one of the reasons is because of the constitutional amendment we passed last time with the sales tax. Now, let's make sure it's spent fairly throughout the entire state instead of focused in certain areas. And sometimes an election makes that happen.
A lot of talk, too, about tort reform. I would say that if I was a gambling man, yes. I would say that there will be a tort reform measure of some shape, fashion, or form.
And if you gambled on that, you would win. I'm fairly confident some level of tort reform will come out.
You think that one definitely, some form of that comes out of your joint committee when y'all meet to refer them out?
If I were a gambling woman, yes. I would say
that you've never set foot in a casino before, have you?
I would say that some form of tort reform will be referred out.
What else do you think has legitimately a good shot? You talked about the ethics law. It's got a couple of different moving parts to it. Do you think that one has?
You know, what's interesting to me is the discussion about the election of more discussion than I expected about the election of game and fish officers and highway commissioners. That's gotten a little bit of a buzz. Kind of surprised me.
Yeah. All right. Anything in there that you see that you'd be willing to go on the record as saying, I think that's a terrible idea. I'm going to make sure as the chairwoman of this committee, that one never sees the light of day.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because after sitting there in my freshman year and then last year and this year, I want to make sure that all 20 members of the committee feel equal in getting to have their voice heard. I didn't feel that way 2 years ago, and I didn't feel that way 4 years ago. So no, I'm not willing to say as a chairman, I'm purposely going to kill something. Because I want all 100 of us in the House are equal, and I want them to all feel that way. I certainly didn't feel that way.
Representative Andrea Lee is the chairwoman of the House State Agencies Committee, and she recently spoke to Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Aren't we missing somebody?
I know, it's weird.
He's on vacation.
Hey, if the girls are the only ones here,
we can have some fun.
We could.
Let's talk when we get off the air.
Okay.
All right. An artist named Amos Paul Kennedy Jr. He's a printer, he's a philosopher, he's an activist. He will lecture at 5:30 today in room 213 of the Fine Arts Building at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And also at 5:30 tomorrow in the Borum Conference Center, room 101 of the Baldor Technology Center at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith.
So a couple chances to catch this guy.
Sounds like he's a very interesting person. Both of those are free, and you can find out more at 575-7987 in Fayetteville or 788-7333 in the River Valley. If you remember the Caravan Sarai performance at the Walton Arts Center, this is kind of part of it. There's a Moroccan film screening and filmmaker discussion tonight at 6 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. Some other events have been going on around this week, and you can find out more at 856-7250.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So you think you know it all. What do James and Charles Rossman and Julius Caesar have in common? Walt is in Wheeling, West Virginia. You're bound to, I'm surprised no one's calling from town, probably.
We're all here.
Huh?
We're all here.
We're all here, okay. I'm Michael Feldman. Join me this week for fun, laughs, and the quiz on the What Do You Know Radio Hour from PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know? Saturday mornings at 10 here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Desmond Shaw Taylor is the surveyor of the Queen's pictures, the curator of the paintings in the Royal Collection of Great Britain. He, along with Anna Summer Cox, editor of the art newspaper, will be speaking at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art Friday evening. I spoke with Desmond yesterday over the phone from Oklahoma City, where he is also speaking. As the Royal Collection is one of the largest collections of art in the world, I began by asking him if, in his nearly 10 years as surveyor, he has seen all of the paintings.
Probably not, because definitely not, because they unlike a museum where they're either on the walls or in a store, these are dotted around palaces and houses lived in by members of the royal family around Britain. So the job of seeing the works is that's quite a task. And in many cases, they're very happy where they are. I don't need to see them, but
right.
It would be good eventually.
So what is a day like for you?
Well, it's really a lot of it is like a mainstream museum curating nowadays, which is a mixture of being engaged in the business of or being part of the management of a part of the heritage industry. The Royal Collection Trust, which is the body I work for, is we manage the opening of Windsor Castle and the Buckingham Palace summer opening and Holyrood in Edinburgh, and it's actually a very big business, so I need to be involved in that. So that's one half, and then the other half a lot of the time is exhibitions. We have an exhibition space in London called the Queen's Gallery next to Buckingham Palace, which puts on a temporary exhibition program of works only from the Royal Collection. And that's really our main kind of stage, I suppose, upon which we can explain the collection in greater depth.
So why is it important for the public to see this great collection?
Well, a lot of reasons. I mean, firstly, it's an absolutely fundamental part of the heritage of the people of Great Britain. This is their history, and there are the sites that's the heritage. Windsor Castle, you know, it's one of the first things that, or the sort of prime locations for Britain. Buckingham Palace, it's pretty big. It's sort of like the White House in that respect.
Right.
It's got that kind of significance. But then also, it's just the complexity of the art objects, the range, the quality, takes you way out of that story into a million other different stories which we need to tell. Otherwise, they're just going to waste.
And the paintings and artwork, it doesn't just focus on one particular type of art. I mean, it's not just Renaissance. It's not just contemporary.
It's from all periods. And it just depends upon what kings and queens have collected over the years. And they've collected, you know, a huge range of things. Some very central and what you'd expect of a monarchy. You know, that Charles I brought great Flemish portrait painter Van Dyck to paint him and his court. So, you know, great Van Dyck portraits are absolutely central. But on the other hand, also, you know, at other eras, the kings bought just beautiful 17th century Dutch paintings.
Is Her Majesty the Queen, does she continue to grow the collection and make acquisitions?
Yeah, she certainly does, and so do other members of the royal family. Not at anything like the rate that happened, you know, in the past. And that's partly because so many other art institutions have grown up in the last 200 years that have taken over that role as the prime acquiring bodies.
When I was a teenager, I visited London and kind of all over England a little bit, but I was lucky enough to stay at Hampton Court Palace. And
oh, wow.
I know it was an awesome experience. Is that collection there? I know King Henry VIII, that was his home.
Yes.
Is that part of the collection as well?
Everything in Hampton Court, or pretty much everything in Hampton Court, is part of the Royal Collection. So all the paintings and tapestries and the management and the building, the palace, belongs to the Queen. It's part of the crown properties. But the management is a different organization called Historic Royal Palaces.
Well, so in Arkansas, you'll be visiting our new museum, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art.
Yeah.
Do you have, is there American art in the collection?
A small, small group and some odd and unexpected things. Very, very important group of paintings by Benjamin West, who was George III's favorite painter. So, you know, just at the moment that George III managed to lose America, he got himself a really good American painter, which is a little bit surprising. So, yeah, there are examples. And funnily enough, in my office, I have a Stuart portrait of George Washington, you know, like the one that hangs in the White House, which also joined the collection. It was given in the 19th century to the Prince of Wales on his visit to America. So, yeah, there are examples.
I noticed as I was looking at the website for the Royal Collection that there's a coming exhibit this summer to mark the anniversary of the crowning of the Queen.
Yes.
And it's portraits of the Queen.
Well, it will be regalia, crowns, sections of film, as well as portraits. So it'll be a sort of celebration with all the objects and regalia of the 60 years since the coronation.
Did I see that there's an Andy Warhol?
Yes.
He's an American artist.
Yeah, he's right there. Yeah, I missed him.
Right. I find that curious, I guess. Andy Warhol, Prince of
well, the it's, it, I mean, it's not, it, they're not typical of the collection as a whole, as you can imagine, but right. I suppose there are certain things like that that have joined the collection because they're so absolutely iconic, you know, of the Queen.
Oh, so when you arrive at Crystal Bridges, will you tour the grounds and in our collection here?
Yeah, surely that's what we're looking forward to. I mean, we're definitely, because I mean, in the Royal Collection, I'm generally looking at old palaces, not new museums.
Right.
So it's great to get out of my shell.
I can imagine that the architecture is completely different.
It's going to be different.
Yes. A little bit. Well, so what can we expect to hear you speak about, you and Anna?
I'm going to be just giving a little bit of an introduction to the Royal Collection, which I'm assuming will be a bit unfamiliar and in a good way, a bit weird in some ways, and just giving a bit of an idea of the strengths, but maybe also the challenges for the future. That it's brief is not absolutely simple like that of a museum. It's got to adapt the way the monarchy does. So I'll be giving a little bit of an introduction to that. And Anna's going to be talking about royal collections, particularly in it being formed now, today, particularly in the Gulf, where Gulf rulers are literally behaving like the great monarchs of the past in forming collections. And then we hope that we will start a conversation and take questions, and I'd just be really interested in where that leads, you know, what people's reaction will be, how much they know about the Royal Collection already, and what they think about it.
Right.
Because it's, you know, its future isn't an easy and decided thing. We could go in so many different directions, and I'm kind of far enough away from home just to listen to what people might say without worrying about it getting back, if you know what I mean.
Yes, you are pretty far away from home.
Yeah. But you know, if we're having a discussion in Britain, it's sort of more uncomfortable. Should we do this? Should we do that? Here you can just stand back and think about it.
Yes, and the people here maybe aren't quite so invested in it. Also.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's exactly. Mm-hmm. It's exactly right. It's
right.
So I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be. I'll be very interested to know which way the discussion goes.
Good, good. Well, will you be staying in the States for very long, or is it
just this week?
Just this week.
So we're flying back on Sunday. So
okay.
Good, but in like my New Year holiday.
And maybe visiting places you haven't visited before.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been to Dallas and Fort Worth before, but not Oklahoma and not Arkansas. So it's definitely new places.
All right. Well, we are happy to have you. I don't believe I have anything else.
Well, great. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Desmond.
That's
I appreciate
great pleasure.
It.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.
Desmond Shaw Taylor is surveyor of the Queen's pictures for the Royal Collection in London.
He'll be speaking, along with Anna Summer Cox, editor of the art newspaper, at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art Friday evening at 6:30. I spoke with him over the phone from Oklahoma City yesterday. For more information, crystalbridges.org.
Yura and Elisa Margulis are siblings from a musical family, but they didn't necessarily grow up playing music together that often. Yura is 12 years older and was well into his teens before Elisa was playing music. Yura lives here. He is the Emily J. McAllister Professor of Piano at the University of Arkansas. Elisa lives in Europe. But they'll perform together in Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the U of A campus Thursday night at 8. This week, they came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio to talk with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums and Katie Hendrickson about their music, Thursday night's program, and their early years of music.
By the time I was a teenager, and I have two younger sisters, they were so much younger that it was mostly older brother abuse kind of interaction.
But my first public concert when I was like 5, I played with you.
That's true.
In my school.
Yes.
And we have pictures.
Yeah.
You don't remember what you played, do you?
I think I
played... Tchaikovsky was there.
Tchaikovsky, A Small Waltz or something. Mm-hmm. And I think a Chrysler piece.
That's Fritz a long Chrysler. Time ago. On an upright piano, no?
Yeah.
You were how old at the time?
Five or six.
Yeah. And so you were the older brother.
Yeah. I'm 12 years older.
So was that exciting for you? Or
yeah, actually, I remember I was really proud that I played my first time and with my brother, and I felt so very secure from this. You know?
That's true. I mean, so the memories are, you know, they're multifaceted. Of course, we talked about music. Of course, we shared a passion of music. Of course, we still do.
Yeah.
And we talk about music. But I mean, once you play together, you don't talk so much. You express yourself more at the instruments.
Well, it's interesting that you're still close because I have a brother who is just 7 years older, and we kind of grew up separately, and we don't share many of the same interests. We get along, but so a 12-year gap, that's great.
But it's also our family.
Yes.
Everybody is a musician, and it was just, you know, connected with music.
Yeah, and the entire family is musical, professionally musical.
Yeah.
So that binds people together.
Was that expected? I mean, to be professionally musical as opposed to
Actually, not. For me, it wasn't so expected because I chose another instrument than everybody else because everyone played piano and I decided to play violin. And I never felt pressure that I have to become a violinist from my parents.
She's the smart one in the family.
Because?
Because she chose not the piano.
Yeah. I thought it was too much concurrence with my dad, my mom, my brother, and my sister also. Then
she played the piano. My older younger sister played the piano for a long time before she switched to cello. She's now a cellist professional.
Well, and you're also smart because when you go somewhere to play a concert, you have your instrument.
Yes, I'm so jealous of that.
Well, that's a whole nother story with the violins, because right now I actually don't have my own violin.
Oh.
I'm looking for one. I'm searching for an instrument. It's a long, very, very long story and a very complicated world of string instruments that not everybody probably is familiar. But the violins and cellos, they, you know, the prices are going so high because, of course, the best instruments are the really old Italians and they are unbelievably expensive now. And it's hard to choose to play on something else after I had the luck to play on great instruments on loan. And now I would like to have my own violin, but I'm spoiled.
Well, let's talk about Beethoven and the Kreutzer Sonata, which you're playing. Why were you drawn to performing this work together?
Well, we were looking for a substantial Beethoven sonata to play together, and the Kreutzer is one of the largest, most difficult pieces for both instruments independently and together. It's a real challenge. It's a big, you know, mountain.
And talk a little bit about those challengers and how you overcame them as musicians.
Well, the Kreutzer Sonata, yeah, it's really one of the most difficult sonatas, even I would say in general, for piano and violin duo. And it's very difficult alone also, just the solo part. And together, it's, you know, it's a big work.
I think also we play a good deal of the sort of mainstream piano, violin, duo repertoire, you know, the Franck Sonata, the Prokofiev Sonata, and so on. And the Kreutzer is just one of those main things that one just has to play eventually, and now was the time.
And have you guys played it for very long together, or is this a new thing?
It's a new thing.
Yeah.
What's that like when you approach a new thing? I mean, what's the first? Okay, you've made the decision. This is what we're going to do. I imagine that you've worked independently of each other, but the first time you come together, do you start at the top?
Yeah. I must say, of course, but I must say my sister has a lot of experience in chamber music, more than myself. And so she did you probably played this already, no?
I did.
Yeah, so she most things that you can imagine she already performed with great pianists. And so usually when we meet for the first time, I just do what she says.
But actually, we just play. That's the great thing to play together. That there's not so much to really talk and discuss. It's very clear what, you know, we just play and it gets better just by playing.
Of course. And
we hardly ever have to, like, speak about ideas because they're there already.
Right. The more you repeat, let's say, certain phrases, the more you understand each other, what the other one sort of sees or hears in that place, and there's a consensus is found without words.
You have a CD as well.
Yes.
Where did you record that?
We recorded it in Berlin, in a very, very fine recording studio, Teldex Studio.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Conditions. Yeah. Actually, we played here also, I remember.
Yeah.
We played here the full recital of the CD recording and played some piece here in the radio.
We played some here, that's true. Before the recording, we rehearsed here also in Fayetteville.
We played here this romance from Liszt.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, we recorded this whole Franz Liszt repertoire CD.
See, 2011 was the Liszt bicentennial anniversary, and we recorded a CD of very rare repertoire, everything Liszt wrote for violin and piano, which there's not so much, but we recorded all of it, basically.
That was a challenge also.
That was a challenge, yeah. It's a special project
really
altogether.
Really challenge, yeah.
Well, you're going to be performing, it's the 28th, Thursday night.
Yes.
Yeah. Excited?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We rehearse all day long together. Like,
it's
we practice, we rehearse. Like these days.
Okay, you say you practice, rehearse. Are you using those as synonyms, or does that
mean? No, I mean, like, the way we spend the weekend, for example, we wake up and then, you know, we have coffee and then we, like, okay, first we practice alone. So for a couple of hours, practice alone. Then we practice together. Then we find out what is missing. Then we practice alone. Then we meet again. We practice together.
And, of course, besides this repertoire, we both also prepare other programs.
Right. In between, Alisa is practicing, like, a Brahms concerto and, I don't know, other repertoire, and I'm practicing solo repertoire. I also have to prepare.
How is it different playing with a sibling as opposed to playing with any other type of musician, or is it different for you?
Yes. It's just, I don't know, maybe more freedom, and it's more relaxed, and you feel more kind of safe.
Well, you know, artist personalities are very sensitive, and I think if you play with people that are, let's say, even friends or people that you meet for the first time and so on, there are always contentions, you know, like if something goes wrong, you will, for example, you could become upset with the other person. For me, my sister cannot do wrong. And she feels very safe that way. I mean, there's nothing she can possibly do that will in any way upset me, you know.
Well,
well, I mean, you know, you have pulled enough that I know the case.
But actually, it's true on stage, it never happens. It's
in addition, always, on stage where I always...
Well, in rehearsals, there's always things, you know, you don't concentrate 100% like on stage, and then on stage it's very exciting to play together.
Yeah.
It's always different.
Remember we played this one time in Freiburg where we really had just a few hours before the concert to meet on stage, and playing through, we realized we're not exactly sure how this whole thing goes, you know, like this entire program. And we're like, okay, well, you know, meet you at the concert on stage. And then, you know, the concert was all right.
And then
it was very exciting.
Yeah. It's all supporting each other very much.
It's fun, you know.
Yura and Elisa Margulis will perform tomorrow night at 8 inside the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. The concert is free. Their CD together is titled Franz Liszt, Works for Piano and Violin. You can find out more at their individual websites, yuramargulis.com and elisamargulis.com. They talked with Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen and Kyle Kellums earlier this week. You can hear them talk more about the musical selections for their concert tomorrow on Of Note with Katie Henriksen at 11 here on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is the Executive Director of Downtown Bentonville Incorporated, known as DBI,
yes.
Daniel Hintz. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How about you, Kyle?
Very good. First Friday is Friday.
Mm-hmm. The first one.
The first Friday.
The first Friday of the entire season, which runs March through November. This one is themed midway to St. Patrick's Day. It's on March 1st, and we're actually extending the excitement of the Irish theme through the next day on March 2nd as well. So these things just keep getting bigger and bigger.
This is what year for First Fridays?
Wow, we started a version of First Friday in August of 2008. And let me tell you, don't ever start an outdoor festival in August in Arkansas. Lesson learned.
Yes.
But these things have expanded ever since
then. Mm-hmm. It survived.
It has survived.
This year, again, music, culinary, the whole sort of...
Absolutely. Each one is themed differently. Each theme sort of highlights various elements of downtown Bentonville. And then we try to incorporate sort of some of the things that are happening here in Northwest Arkansas as well. So we hope it becomes a regional event as well.
In the past, music has been available around lunchtime and early evening. Mm-hmm. This year, you're going to make it throughout the weekend.
Well, it depends on the first Friday. It depends on a lot of the elements that we have with the productions. But we always have a lunch concert that goes from 11:30 to 1. Great opportunity to just come down, grab some lunch, listen to some great music. But the main festivities really are between 5 and 8 p.m. Though, as you get further into the summer, those festivities do extend into the Bentonville Parks and Rec Department does a Friday night flicks. We're going to be taking several of the bands and starting to put them into venues throughout the downtown area.
Nice.
So we're really using this as an opportunity to extend the nightlife. Hey, if you're already in downtown, you've already parked and are hanging out, it's a great opportunity for you to check out downtown and to hang out for a lot longer than just the First Friday experience.
Now, this first one, as you mentioned, is midway to St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
Irish St. Patrick's theme.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, last year we had a little bit of challenges with the weather, which seems to be a theme in March. So the bands that we had last year, we're actually bringing back. They're absolutely phenomenal. We have a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Ramsey. Now, he's good old rebel, sort of pub tunes, solo artist. He's going to be performing from 11:30 to 1 and then back again at 5 o'clock. But then he's going to head over to the Press Room, which is sort of a coffee house experience in downtown. And he'll be performing that evening starting about 7:30 till about 9. And then he'll be coming back on Saturday, about 7:30, the same time at the Press Room again. We're going to have the Ozark Highlanders, which is always a pleasure to have around. And if you've heard them play, they're absolutely phenomenal. We're delighted to have them back again this year. And then the headliner for the evening is the $3 Band out of Kansas City. They sort of do a mixture of both Irish music, some Americana music, some Appalachian, which is, of course, informed by the Irish musical traditions. But they throw in a few other elements with their musical tastes as well. So it's a little bit of traditional, but it really does caters to a larger audience.
You wouldn't necessarily look at them and pigeonhole them as, quote, Irish band.
Correct, correct. But they can do a good reel when they need to.
And they're going to be at 21C as well?
Yes. Right after they get done, they're going to hightail it over to The Hive at 21C Museum Hotel. And they're going to be performing there at The Hive that evening. And then on Saturday, they're going to be over at Tuscan Trotter that evening, starting at 8 o'clock. And all this is made possible through some partnerships we have with Signature Bank and the Walton Arts Center and the Walmart Visitor Center, those kind of folks. And so we have a lot of people sort of coming together as a team to help make this happen.
At the Visitor Center, Walmart, don't you do things for First Friday?
Absolutely. This particular one, they're going to have a whole special ice cream scoop with chocolate chip mint, of course, a little bit of green with that Irish piece there, with Yarnell's ice cream. I don't know if you've known, but they actually turned the Spark Cafe, which is more of a coffee-driven experience, which is now an ice cream shop.
I did not know this.
And so you can go in there and get a great ice cream scoop from Yarnell's, which is an awesome Arkansas-based company.
Yes, again.
Mm-hmm.
Open again.
Yes, that's right.
And then there's a reception.
As often with First Fridays, you have our restaurants and our retailers sort of jumping on board and having fun with this. Over at Noberta Philbrook Art Gallery, which is on West Central, you have a opening for Erica Nelson, you know, a wonderful artist. And so she'll be showcased at Noberta Philbrook. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, the Walmart Visitor Center will be having some special events. 21C will be offering some special beverages that evening. So, for an example, a lot of the retailers and restaurants jump on board, open up for extra hours, and kind of look at some different programming.
I want to ask you about the $3 band at 21C, because mm-hmm. you're at the Hive, which is the bar restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Where will they be? I've been in there once. Where will they be? Is there a stage? Is there?
There isn't a stage. Basically, when you first walk in the door, there will be on the left-hand side where the windows are facing the Hive. Mm-hmm. They'll be placed right there. This is something new in the space, but they've just recently opened. And
right.
so they're really sort of playing and experimenting. They've been wonderful partners of ours and very much already involved in downtown Bentonville.
I know when they first broke ground and we did the first story on 21C, they mentioned that maybe some small concerts would be part of their
mm-hmm.
repertoire.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those examples.
Okay. So this first Friday is the first?
Yes. Yes. It's the first Friday. Lots of stuff. And then it spills into the March 2nd. And then we go on for the full season where every first Friday of the month from March through November, we have a first Friday event. Some of these events have actually turned into full weekend festivals, music festivals. So you can go to our website at downtownbentonville.org to keep up with all the happenings with the first Friday and more in downtown Bentonville.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As governors gathered in Washington, President Obama seized the moment to lobby them on the looming sequester.
I hope that you speak with your congressional delegation and remind them in no uncertain terms, exactly what is at stake.
I'm Neil Conan, Ken Rudin, our political junkie on the March 1st deadline and election results from Illinois, actual votes. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. KUAF is supported by All My Treasures, a flea market and antique mall on Highway 16 East in Fayetteville. Serving interior designers, collectors, and dealers for 26 years with memorabilia, antiques, furniture, and more. Open Monday through Saturday, 10 to 6, and Sundays from 1 until 6. 575-0250 for more information. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Rogers, Fort Smith, Fayetteville, and London.
Nice. Where is London?
It's off of I-40, just kind of southeast of Clarksville.
Yes. It's one of those things I always see on the sign and I don't ever actually get off to go.
Right.
Have you been to London?
I mean, I've driven through, but no, I've never stopped.
We'll have to stop sometime.
Yeah, we will.
But obviously because of the guy we talked to from
right.
London today,
right.
which was a really fun right. story.
It was. It was good. It was really exciting to talk to him, too. So.
Excellent. And yesterday you got to talk to somebody cool about archaeology.
I did. An archaeologist mm-hmm. that researches Chaco Canyon, an
yeah.
area in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like all these ruins that are 1,000 years old.
Right.
I don't know. Pretty cool.
It sounded really cool.
Yeah. And in honor of Archaeology Month, mm-hmm. which is coming in March, the Hobbs State Park Conservation Area is offering an archaeology boat tour.
Oh.
It's this Sunday at 1. The tour will depart from Rocky Branch Marina.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting what you see, what kind of archaeology there is
and that's
around Beaver
right
Lake.
Here, so you don't have to go
yeah.
all the way to Chaco
right.
Canyon. Good deal. And a quick reminder that the Full Circle Campus Food Pantry's annual food fight food drive that began on February 16th will wrap up on March 5th. That's next Tuesday. So you still have time to do that.
Right.
If you would like some more information, you can contact Daniel Carruth by emailing pantry@uark.edu. Ozarks at Large mm-hmm. is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large at noon. I'll be back along with Christina.
Yes, right.
And we have some fun stories for you tomorrow.
All over again. Thanks for listening.